Welcome to Harlow on Healthcare. I'm David Harlow, and I invite you to join me by my virtual hearth as I sit down with healthcare leaders to discuss building the future of healthcare. Today, my guest is Abner Mason. He is the founder and CEO of Consejo Sano. He's a healthcare technology leader who's dedicated to creating a more just, equitable, and effective healthcare system. At Consejo Sano, a multicultural patient engagement company, he leads a team that works every day to improve outcomes and lower costs on behalf of health plans. He's also the founder and chair of Health Tech for Medicaid, a nonprofit working to radically change the pace of innovation to improve care quality and access. He serves on boards of the California Black Health Network and Manifest MedX, California's largest HIE, and he's a member of the American Medical Association's External Equity and Innovation Advisory Group. He is also a policy wonk with experience at the federal and state levels. And Abner, I believe we just missed each other in the hallways of Beacon Hill in Boston. We were in state government there just a few years apart, I believe.
That's right.
Welcome. Welcome. And thank you for joining us, Abner.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
I wonder if, for starters, you could say a little bit more about Consejo Sano and what is front and center for you today.
Sure. So at Consejo Sano, we are really a health equity company. We're trying to do our part to make our healthcare system work better for everyone who calls this country home. And that increasingly includes a lot of people that are broadly, you know, called multicultural, people for whom culture and language is the barrier. At Consejo Sano, that's our sweet spot. We serve everyone, all patients and all health plan members. But typically, we initially are called in more often than not because a health plan or a provider is having difficulty engaging their multicultural patients or health plan members. And they've tried a number of things, approaches, and nothing seems to work to build a more trusted relationship with those members or those patients and to navigate them into healthcare at the right time in the right place. And so at Consejo Sano, we've really developed, an expertise in reaching these hard to reach populations, which includes multicultural people, low-income people, people with low health literacy, and others who just struggle to connect with the healthcare system. That's, our sweet spot in terms of how we've made our name and reputation. And as we've grown, of course, we now, as I said, we serve all health plan members and clients and patients.
So that communication is critical, of course. You can have a wonderful program without communicating it, without reaching people who need it. And that's really sort of a multi-pronged approach that's needed in order to reach people, right? It's the message, it's the messenger, it's the mode of communication. And I'm wondering if you can put a little color on that, the
Sure.
question of, what's been missing? Why is this a problem?
So I think that's a really good question, David. And it goes back to our country, the U.S., we've experienced a dramatic demographic change over the last five decades. We have become a much more multicultural country. In fact, the state where we're headquartered, headquartered in Los Angeles. We serve clients across the country, but we're headquartered in Los Angeles. Here in California, California is today a majority minority state. So is Texas. And according to the last the census, the whole country will be majority minority in 2045. So our country's changing, big demographic changes. So that's one of the reasons we have the challenges we do. Our healthcare system hasn't kept up with those demographic changes. And so our healthcare system, in the way it engages with patients and health plan members, works today much like it did in 1970. But the patient population or the population has just changed dramatically. And that mismatch between supply and demand, the way our healthcare system engages and the need for a different way of engaging to actually build trust and connect with the America that we've become, that imbalance between supply and demand, really, it creates poor health outcomes for people and it creates a higher cost for society. And I'll provide a little more detail. The way that the healthcare system today has responded to the demographic changes is kind of an old style approach. I call it the 1.0 model of engagement. Basically, you take the same message that's intended to engage the patient, to educate them, to communicate with them and convince them to take certain action. That message is typically written by an English speaker for an English speaker. It may be translated across many different languages because of the changes in the patient population or regulatory requirements, but it's the same message just translated, and it's usually not translated well. That approach, that one size fits all, the same, if you and I belong to the same health plan, David, you and I would get the same message, but we're completely different people. We have a different life journey. We have a different level of trust for the health system. We have different income levels that determine whether we can engage. We have, you know, cultural backgrounds and that shape how we view, how we trust, whether we're willing to engage, whether we're willing to even go into to a clinic, and as we see with the COVID vaccine, whether we're willing to take a vaccine or not, all of these things that make us who we are, they shape who we are. The way healthcare works today is it basically says we don't want to know about those things. Don't tell us. Don't talk about it. We're going to treat you all the same. That approach of sort of telling people who they are doesn't matter. The things that really make them who they are at their core doesn't matter. That's not the way to build trust, but that's the way our healthcare system works today in the way it engages. And what we've said is at Consejo Sano is that we've just got to stop doing that. We have to stop treating people like who they are doesn't matter.
That's really such a problem across the board. We've seen it in so many different ways through different lenses over the years. The example that sort of leaps to mind as I hear you talking, Abner, is the case of Chevrolet marketing a car in Latin America in the 70s that was called the Nova, which of course means, you know, Nova doesn't go in Spanish, right? That was preposterously dumb in retrospect, but we're still kind of doing the same thing is what I hear you saying.
We're doing the same thing in healthcare. Today in America, our healthcare system is just not equipped to serve the multicultural country that we've become. So we're doing the exact same thing. I mean, you know, we're still faxing, which is kind of crazy if you think about it.
Yes, that. Yes.
So it's not like this is the only, our healthcare system just hasn't kept up with the changes in technology. If you look across the culture, part of the reason this is such a problem is that patients have come to expect better. You're treated better by Netflix or Amazon in the sense of their willingness to understand who you are and to tailor their services to you. I guarantee you, David, if you and I have the same Netflix account, they do not treat us the same way. You have a different list of preferences. They recommend different things to you based on what you've looked at in the past. Same thing with Amazon. But if we have the same health plan, we get treated the same way. They don't see the distinctions. And so people are accustomed now to being treated like who they are matters. They're accustomed to a higher level of personalization. And healthcare in America has got to sort of step out of the old mode of treating everybody basically the same, one size fits all, and customize the experience. Because I think the current COVID situation has shown us clearly that there's not a lot of trust for the health system. And if we're going to build trust going forward and make our health system work for everybody, we have got to employ strategies that at their core build trust. And my belief, our belief at Consejo Sano, is one of the core ways you build trust is to treat people like who they are matters, to connect with them in a more personal way. And today we have the ability to do that. We can, you know, that's what we're doing at Consejo Sano. We use data and a technology platform that we built that allows us to parse that data and do analytics on it. And we built a team that comes from the community we're trying to serve. And the combination of the data and the technology platform and the people allows us to engage in a much more personalized, customized way that builds trust. And that's the key thing that I think is missing.
That's a critical piece. And what I hear you saying, though, is you're talking about the last mile, if you will. How are we communicating? How are we connecting the healthcare system to folks who need better access to it? The question that I would pose to you is, how do we go further back up the food chain, so to speak, and think about the policies that need to be changed, the resources that need to be allocated at a macro level. And then we have something to talk about. Then we have something to communicate, right? Is there a disconnect there? You're working with health plans who are seeing the light, so to speak, and are interested in this sort of engagement, and that's sort of the word of the decade, right? But how do we go back up the food chain and redesign healthcare?
Really good question. I think one thing that we should touch on is that I've talked a lot about what we see as one of the big challenges that we face because of the demographic changes. It just makes the healthcare system hasn't kept up, and so it's hard to build trust and engage. But there's another way that our healthcare system is not working like it should, and the two go together. But this other aspect is what I'd call the social determinants of health. We know now in a way that we didn't maybe 40 years ago, but the data is clear that what determines a person's health is not just what happens in a clinic, in a doctor's office, or in a hospital. In fact, according to all of the data that we're seeing now, a person's health is much more determined by these upstream or social determinant of health issues rather than what happens in a clinic visit once or twice or even three or four times a year. It's right. The rest of the year when you're not in the clinic.
The clinic visit is the icing on the cake.
Right. And so but even though we know this now in a way that I think it has permeated, the healthcare system and policymakers know it. We have yet to figure out a way to address those social determinant of health issues in a meaningful way. We still see a complete sort of division between what we call healthcare in America and social services. They're different silos. They don't talk to each other. That's one problem. And we found a way to spend a lot of money on healthcare. But I think if you look at, the U.S. compared to other countries, we're not spending nearly as much on social services. So we've siloed it and we've got an imbalance in where we spend. So there's two broad areas where our healthcare system, I think, needs change. One is we got to figure out how to connect with the country that we become, meaning the much more multicultural country that we become. And then the other aspect is we got to address these SDOH issues, these upstream social determinant of health issues. So when you ask me what policy changes, I think that is where a lot of the attention needs to focus. We've got to change policies because these problems, these challenges I just described, these two big ones, they're too big to solve in a sort of, one-off sort of way. We need to change policy. So I'll give you one example. We should, and it's a good news example. Recently, the Medicare Advantage program has changed to allow Medicare Advantage plans to invest some of the premium dollar in addressing these upstream social determinant of health issues. It's called the Supplemental Benefits Program. It's just started, but it's a step in the right direction. But the sad thing is that Medicaid plans, and we need this even more on the Medicaid side, because that's where low income people are. They don't have that kind of flexibility yet that Medicare Advantage plans have. So the good news is there's a step in the direction of addressing social determinants of health in a more systemic way that is not a one off, but it needs to happen in the Medicaid space as well. But let's applaud progress where we see it, but push to have more of it happen and happen more quickly.
Right. One step at a time, but we'll get there. If you're just tuning in, this is Harlow on Healthcare, coming to you on Healthcare Now Radio. I'm David Harlow, and my guest today is Abner Mason, CEO of Consejo Sano. Abner, taking a step back for a moment, you are talking about effective engagement, and I guess the question I have for you is, how do you leverage a better cultural understanding of the population you and your customers are seeking to serve in order to engage individuals more effectively?
So our approach, that's a really good question, is, our goal is to build a more personalized, customized engagement with each member or each patient. That's the objective, right? So how do you do that? And for us at Consejo Sano, we've decided the way to do that is to really lean into culture. And we define culture as how people, all the things that go into how a person leads their daily life. It includes their history, their ethnic background, their income, where they live, the true things they believe about healthcare, the myths they believe about healthcare. You take all that together, and that's their culture. So our view is that if we can use data, public data and claims data, and combine all of that data in a way that allows us to parse it. And so we built a technology platform that allows us to ingest all of that data. And it's a lot of data. It allows us to do something we call cultural cohorting, which is very, it just means dividing the larger population, whether it's patients or health plan members, into smaller groups based on culture. And then we design the content for the culture. And then we get the mode of communication right. And each of those steps is really important. You got to get the culture right, and then you got to get the language right, and then you got to get the mode of communication right. If you do those three things, what we found is that we get much higher rates of engagement, because when a person gets a message from us, it feels like we have taken the time to get to know who they are. It feels like we understand what their challenges are. It feels like we care about them as opposed to about just what we're trying to accomplish for our client. So that approach, we found that it drives really high engagement. It builds trust. It creates a two-way conversation. Frequently, people are engaging and answering questions. So we're collecting even more information that allows us to guide that patient or that health plan member. So that's how, our approach is we think culture is the best way to connect with people if you want to build trust.
Abner, we're living in the midst of a continuing crisis. People talk about the new normal under COVID. I think of each week as the next normal, because the each week brings new changes to the situation. And we are living in a next normal. And I know that you lived through and worked through another pandemic situation, and I'm thinking about the AIDS crisis, and I'm wondering what lessons you're able to draw from the work you did in that time to what we're facing today.
That's a really good question. I'd say there's a couple of lessons. The first is the importance of pharma and research. HIV/AIDS, when I first got involved, was pretty much a fatal disease for anyone who got it. Just like almost 100% fatality rates. And it was horrible. And because of the research and all of the folks involved in that, government and private sector working together, they created these antiretroviral therapies that have over time made HIV a chronic disease. So first and foremost, we have got to make sure that we never kill the goose that lays the golden egg. And so we've got to protect, research and innovation. It's really important. You just don't know, what's going to happen next. And I remember when the antiretroviral drugs came out, I was like, this is just amazing. This is wonderful. Who would have thought that, 20, 30 years later, we'd need research, research and technology to come up with COVID vaccines? I mean, what has happened with COVID vaccines is a miracle. It's really extraordinary. So first is the importance of research. And I know there's always a push and pull with pharma, but at the end of the day, we need those folks to keep working. And we got to figure out a balanced way to make sure that they're there doing their jobs. That's number one. I think the other lesson that I learned is that it is possible to bring people together beyond the partisanship. HIV/AIDS was an example of where at first it was mostly in the gay and lesbian community, and conservatives weren't that enamored of trying to do it, weren't excited about doing something about it. As we learned more about it, we saw what was happening in Africa, and a lot of conservatives got involved, and President Bush, launched the PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, that focused on Africa. But I remember being at a White House event. It's very interesting. We had ACT UP and Queer Nation and gay groups there, and you had Jerry Falwell and conservative groups there. And this is an odd coming together. These people didn't agree about anything else, but what they did agree about was that one thing was that it was important to have U.S. leadership when it comes to fighting HIV/AIDS. They came at it from different perspectives, but I saw a coalition come together that ultimately, I think, led to, you know, some of the huge successes we've seen with HIV becoming a chronic condition as opposed to killing almost everyone who had it. So that's another lesson I draw. And I think we can do that now, despite the partisanship, despite, you know, you look at the numbers and the time.
Yeah, I was going to say we're just so much more fractured and polarized today than we were then, even though back then we looked pretty darn fractured and polarized. It seems to be getting only worse.
Maybe I'm a little more optimistic that having been through that and seen up close people who were hated each other basically, but could come together. So I'm a bit more optimistic that, you know, if we can keep our focus, you're not going to get everybody, but I think we can get the broad swaths of America to support initiatives that make sense and that, you know, do have some basis in science. So I think I'm optimistic that we'll get there. It won't be easy, but I am optimistic because I've seen it happen before.
One of the things we were talking about earlier is sort of the question of sort of bridging cultural divides and promoting ideas in a way that's going to be culturally appropriate. And there's been a tremendous amount of vaccine resistance. There's been a tremendous amount of theorizing about why different populations are resistant to vaccines. Some have proven to be accurate. Some have proven to not be accurate. Sort of broadening from that question out, how do you collect information that informs the cultural appropriateness of your communication strategies? Where does that come from? How do you figure that part out?
So a key part of the process is, on the one hand, collecting race, ethnicity, and language data from patients and health plan members. That's a huge problem in America today. It's 2021, and we still aren't collecting that kind of information the way we should. And so that causes a huge problem because it doesn't allow us to analyze the data or to be able to analyze the data in the way that can be most useful to us, because we don't have the race, ethnicity, and language data in a robust way. So we need to solve that problem. I think that is another policy area where we're going to have to, you know, we've asked and asked and asked, and I think we've got to start to require the collection of that kind of information for participation in, for instance, you know, government programs like Medicaid and Medicare Advantage and even commercial. But it's really important that we collect that data. So that's part of it. But on the other hand, we've got to figure out how people consume healthcare, what they believe about healthcare. How do we engage them in a way that is going to build trust? And what we found is there's two sources of that information. One is academic, and there's a lot of academic work and research that we can take advantage of that describes and goes into much detail about how different cultural subgroups across the country think and behave and also specifically think about healthcare. But what we've also found is really helpful at Conseil Sano, at least, is hiring people who come from those communities. It's the combination of that real life lived experience and the sort of academic research. When you combine those two together, so you're getting, you know, folks who have walked in the shoes of a person who is on Medicaid, who lives in the Rio Grande Valley, who's first generation, the English is maybe not spoken in the home, they speak Spanish. When you hire people who have that lived experience and combine that with the academic research, it really starts to give you a good sense of how to engage and what to say and how to say it. But with all of that said, it's still a complicated big country changing all the time. So we do a lot of A/B testing. I don't mean to sit here and tell you, you know, we got it covered. We know everything. We figured it all out. It just isn't true, because every day America's changing. I mean, there are certain neighborhoods in this country, they change so much over like a 2-year period that you go back and you're like, oh my God, what happened? It's so different. And so we're constantly having to learn and to test and to see what kind of messaging will drive the outcomes that we want. And typically that means actually getting someone into a clinic to close a gap in care.
So that's the ultimate goal, of course, right? Closing gaps in care and reaching people in effective ways in order to be able to do that. So you're doing that, I imagine, not only in California, but around the country. My understanding is that you're working with health plans primarily. Are you also working with provider organizations?
So yeah, so we're headquartered in Los Angeles, but we work, you know, some of our health plan clients are like, you know, United and Anthem and Humana and Molina, yeah, and HCSC and Blue Shield of California and many, many, many others. I won't name them all. And so we work with these clients in multiple states. So we're probably in 20 states or so now. Our goal is to grow and to continue growing with our clients. Most of our work is in Medicaid today, but we're growing our Medicare Advantage work. And we also work significantly in the exchange populations. These are the folks who get their insurance through the ACA exchange in their state. Most of those people would be on Medicaid, but they make a dollar too much to qualify for Medicaid. So they're still low income typically. So our prime, we're about 90% Medicaid, you know, maybe 7 or 8% Medicare Advantage today, and then exchange populations. But we're growing our Medicare Advantage business quite a bit, because the Medicare Advantage program within Medicare is such a fast growing program. And a lot of plans are trying to figure out, how do they engage with that senior in a way that's going to build trust from day one? And how do I make my plan sticky? Because what we found, and we have data, if you treat people like who they are matters, they will pick your plan over others. They won't walk. And the reverse is true. If people start to hear that they're being treated better by that, you know, that other people are being treated better by their plan, it's more personalized, more customized, they're going to walk. And so a lot of, you know, Medicare Advantage plans are reaching out to us and saying, help us build that more personalized, customized experience for our members. And we do sometimes work directly with providers and health systems as well. But our clients are mostly health plans.
Well, I'm glad the plans are coming to people like you rather than serving more donuts at recruitment breakfasts. To wrap things up, Abner, I'd like to ask, if you were to wake up tomorrow and find yourself 5 years in the future, what's one thing in healthcare that you would hope or maybe expect to find has changed drastically?
Good question. What I'd love to see is that we have institutionalized across healthcare the collection of race, ethnicity, and language data. And that because we've done that, we now have baseline data on healthcare disparities. We can start to put metrics around. We know that we have, you know, disparities based on race and income, and COVID has shown us just how pernicious and those disparities can be, but we just haven't been able to address them. So if we could collect the race, ethnicity, and language data, get a baseline so we know where these disparities are, and then if we could tie the quality measures in the Medicaid and Medicare Advantage program, so the HEDIS measures and the star rating measures, which are how the plans get measured, if we could include in that, they would be incentives to close disparity gaps. And they couldn't get a 4-star rating, for instance, in Medicare Advantage if they didn't make progress toward closing these disparities. If we could do those things, those couple things, collect the data, race and ethnicity data, get the baseline and include in these quality programs, tie closing gaps in care and closing disparities to the quality performance, we would create a flywheel effect that would take us a long way toward creating a more equitable healthcare system.
Well, that is certainly a goal we can all support. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed the conversation.
You have been listening to Harlow on Healthcare. Join us at healthcarenowradio.com. Let's continue the conversation on building the future of healthcare together at #HarlowOnHC. I'm David Harlow, keeping the fire going and holding a seat open for you. Until next time.